Today, I have a treat for you. We are going to step back in time to 1905. At this time, Miss Mason was sending out her mother's education course correspondence, and farmers were leaving the countryside to find work in the cities of America. This was a time filled with innovation, excitement of new discoveries and technologies were being made to make life more comfortable for more people. But as the Industrial Revolution made its way through the Western world, it affected the way American women were seeing themselves and their work in the home. In 1905, most women stayed home and raised their children, and even if they worked, their children were right there with them. World War I changed that. It took women out of the home, and they haven't returned since. But President Teddy Roosevelt saw the importance of the work of mothers and what it means for a healthy and thriving society. He understood that a mother's work is irreplaceable, and the American home, he shows, is a true growing ground for the nation. My husband, Kevin, kindly offered to read Teddy Roosevelt's speech titled On American Motherhood, as he presented it in Washington, D.C. to the National Congress of Mothers on March 13, 1905. You will find that Teddy Roosevelt is speaking to mothers of all times and all places to be encouraged to continue in the good work we've been called to do. I hope you enjoy. Welcome to However Imperfectly, where homeschooling and homemaking intersect. This podcast is for the homeschool mom who desires to educate her children with a rich Charlotte Mason education and also has meals to put on the table and laundry to sort each day. I am your host, Joy Cherick. I hope you find encouragement as we explore the ideas of Charlotte Mason in the context of our modern homes. Mason provides the principles for living and learning with our children that offers education unlike the one we received and a full life together. We don't have time for the latest educational fad. We need time-tested tools to help us raise and educate our children in truth, beauty, and goodness. I'm sure you will come to find, as I have, that the education we are giving, however imperfectly, exceeds all that we intended or imagined.
In our modern industrial civilization, there are many grave dangers to counterbalance the splendors and the triumphs. It is not a good thing to see cities grow at disproportionate speed relatively to the country. For the small landowners, the men who own their little homes, and therefore, to a very large extent, the men who till farms, the men of the soil, have hitherto made the foundation of lasting national life in every state. And if the foundation becomes either too weak or too narrow, the superstructure, no matter how attractive, is in imminent danger of falling. But far more important than the question of the occupation of our citizens is the question of how their family life is conducted. No matter what that occupation may be, as long as there is a real home, and as long as those who make up that home do their duty to one another, to their neighbors, and to the state, it is of minor consequence whether the man's trade is plied in the country or in the city, whether it calls for the works of the hands or for the work of the head. No piled-up wealth, no splendor of material growth, no brilliance of artistic development will permanently avail any people unless its home life is healthy, unless the average man possesses honesty, courage, common sense, and decency, unless he works hard and is willing at need to fight hard, and unless the average woman is a good wife, a good mother, able and willing to perform the first and greatest duty of womanhood, able and willing to bear and to bring up as they should be brought up, healthy children, sound in body, mind, and character, and numerous enough so that the race shall increase and not decrease. There are certain old truths which will be true as long as this world endures, and which no amount of progress can alter. One of these is the truth that the primary duty of the husband is to be the homemaker, the breadwinner for his wife and children, and that the primary duty of the woman is to be the helpmate, the housewife, and mother. The woman should have ample educational advantages, but save in exceptional cases, the man must be, and she need not be, and generally ought not to be, trained for a lifelong career as the family breadwinner. And therefore, after a certain point, the training of the two must normally be different, because the duties of the two are normally different. This does not mean inequality of function, but it does mean that normally there must be dissimilarity of function. On the whole, I think the duty of the woman the more important, the more difficult, and the more honorable of the two. On the whole, I respect the woman who does her duty even more than I respect the man who does his. No ordinary work done by a man is either as hard or as responsible as the work of a woman who is bringing up a family of small children, for upon her time and strength demands are made not only every hour of the day, but often every hour of the night. She may have to get up night after night to take care of a sick child, and yet must by day continue to do all her household duties as well. And if the family means are scant, she must usually enjoy even her rare holidays, taking her whole brood of children with her. The birth pangs make all men the debtors of all women. Above all, our sympathy and regard are due to the struggling wives among those whom Abraham Lincoln called the plain people, and whom he so loved and trusted. For the lives of these women are often led on the lonely heights of quiet, self-sacrificing heroism. Just as the happiest and most honorable and most useful task that can be set any man is to earn enough for the support of his wife and family, for the bringing up and starting in life of his children, so the most important, the most honorable and desirable task which can be set any woman is to be a good and wise mother in a home marked by self-respect and mutual forbearance, by willingness to perform duty, and by refusal to sink into self-indulgence or avoid that which entails effort and self-sacrifice. Of course, there are exceptional men and exceptional women who can do and ought to do much more than this, who can lead and ought to lead great careers of outside usefulness in addition to, not as substitutes for, their homework. But I'm not speaking of exceptions. I'm speaking of the primary duties. I'm speaking of the average citizens, the average men and women who make up the nation. Inasmuch as I'm speaking to an assemblage of mothers, I shall have nothing whatever to say in praise of an easy life. Yours is the work which is never ended. No mother has an easy time. The most mothers have very hard times, and yet what true mother would barter her experience of joy and sorrow in exchange for a life of cold selfishness, which insists upon perpetual amusement and the avoidance of care, and which often finds its fit dwelling place in some flat, designed to furnish with the least possible expenditure of effort the maximum of comfort and of luxury, but in which there is literally no place for children? The woman who is a good wife, a good mother, is entitled to our respect as is no one else. But he is entitled to it only because, and so long as, she is worthy of it. Effort and self-sacrifice are the law of worthy life for the man as for the woman, though neither the effort nor the self-sacrifice may be the same for the one as for the other. I do not in the least believe in the patient Griselda type of woman, in the woman who submits to gross and long-continued ill-treatment, any more than I believe in a man who tamely submits to wrongful aggression. No wrongdoing is so abhorrent as wrongdoing by a man toward the wife and the children who should arouse every tender feeling in his nature. Selfishness toward them, lack of tenderness toward them, lack of consideration for them, above all, brutality in any form toward them should arouse the heartiest scorn and indignation in every upright soul. I believe in the woman keeping her self-respect just as I believe in the man doing so. I believe in her rights just as much as I believe in the man's, and indeed, a little more. And I regard marriage as a partnership in which each partner is in honor bound to think of the rights of the other as well as of his or her own. But I think that the duties are even more important than the rights. And in the long run, I think that the reward is ampler and greater for duty well done than for the insistence upon individual rights, necessary though this, too, must often be. Your duty is hard, Your responsibility, great. But greatest of all is your reward. I do not pity you in the least. On the contrary, I feel respect and admiration for you. Into the woman's keeping is committed the destiny of the generations to come after us. In bringing up your children, you mothers must remember that while it is essential to be loving and tender, it is no less essential to be wise and firm. Foolishness and affection must not be treated as interchangeable terms, and besides training your sons and daughters in the softer and milder virtues, you must seek to give them those stern and hardy qualities which in afterlife they will surely need. Some children will go wrong in spite of the best training, and some will go right, even when their surroundings are most unfortunate. Nevertheless, an immense amount depends upon the family training. If you mothers, through weakness, bring up your sons to be selfish and to think only of themselves, you will be responsible for much sadness among the women who are to be their wives in the future. If you let your daughters grow up idle, perhaps under the mistaken impression that as you yourselves have had to work hard, they shall know only enjoyment, you are preparing them to be useless to others and burdens to themselves. Teach boys and girls alike that they are not to look forward to live spent in avoiding difficulties, but to lives spent in overcoming difficulties. Teach them that work, for themselves and also for others, is not a curse but a blessing. Seek to make them happy, to make them enjoy life, but seek also to make them face life with a steadfast resolution to wrest success from labor and adversity, and to do their whole duty before God and to man. Surely she who can thus train her sons and her daughters is thrice fortunate among women. There are many good people who are denied the supreme blessing of children, and for these we have the respect and sympathy always due to those who, from no fault of their own, are denied any of the other great blessings of life. But the man or woman who deliberately forego these blessings, whether from viciousness, coldness, shallow-heartedness, self-indulgence, or mere failure to appreciate aright the difference between the all-important and the unimportant, why, such a creature merits contempt as hearty as any visited upon the soldier who runs away in battle, or upon the man who refuses to work for the support of those dependent upon him, and who, though able-bodied, is yet content to eat in idleness the bread which others provide. The existence of women of this type forms one of the most unpleasant and unwholesome features of modern life. If any one is so dim of vision as to fail to see what a thoroughly unlovely creature such a woman is, I wish they would read Judge Robert Grant's novel, Unleavened Bread. Ponder seriously the character of Selma and think of the fate that would surely overcome any nation which developed its average and typical woman along such lines. Unfortunately, it would be untrue to say that this type exists only in American novels. That it also exists in American life is made unpleasantly evident by the statistics as to the dwindling families in some localities. It is made evident in equally sinister fashion by the census statistics as to divorce, which are fairly appalling, for easy divorce is now, as it ever has been, a bane to any nation, a curse to society, a menace to the home, an incitement to married unhappiness and immorality, an evil thing for men and a still more hideous evil for women. These unpleasant tendencies in our American life are made evident by articles such as those which I actually read not long ago in a certain paper, where a clergyman was quoted, seemingly with approval, as expressing the general American attitude when he said that the ambition of any save a very rich man should be to rear two children only, so as to give his children an opportunity, quote, to taste a few of the good things of life, end quote. This man, whose profession and calling should have made him a moral teacher, actually set before others the ideal, not of training children to do their duty, not of sending them forth with stout hearts and ready minds to win triumphs for themselves and their country, not of allowing them the opportunity and giving them the privilege of making their own place in the world, but forsooth, of keeping the number of children so limited that they might taste a few good things. The way to give a child a fair chance in life is not to bring it up in luxury, but to see that it has the kind of training that will give it strength of character. Even apart from the vital question of national life and regarding only the individual interests of the children themselves, happiness in the true sense is 100-fold more apt to come to any given member of a healthy family of healthy-minded children, well brought up, well-educated, but taught that they must shift up. Well-educated, but taught that they must shift for themselves, must win their own way, and by their own exertions make their own positions of usefulness, then it is apt to come to those whose parents themselves have acted on and have trained their children to act on the selfish and sordid theory that the whole end of life is to taste a few good things. The intelligence of the remark is on a par with its morality, for the most rudimentary mental process would have shown the speaker that if the average family in which there are children contained but two children, the nation as a whole would decrease in population so rapidly that in two or three generations it would very deservedly be on the point of extinction, so that the people who had acted on this base and selfish doctrine would be giving place to others with braver and more robust ideals. Nor would such a result be in any way regrettable, for a race that praised such doctrine, that is, a race that practiced race suicide, would thereby conclusively show it was unfit to exist, and that it had better give place to people who had not forgotten the primary laws of their being. To sum up, then, the whole matter is simple enough. If either a race or an individual prefers the pleasure of more effortless ease of self-indulgence to the infinitely deeper, the infinitely higher pleasures that come to those who know the toil and the weariness, but also the joy of hard duty well done, why, that race or that individual must inevitably in the end pay the penalty of leading a life both vapid and ignoble. No man and no woman really worthy of the name can care for the life spent solely or chiefly in the avoidance of risk and trouble and labor. Save in exceptional cases, the prizes worth having in life must be paid for, and the life worth living must be a life of work for a worthy end, and ordinarily of work more for others than for oneself. The woman's task is not easy. No task worth doing is easy, but in doing it, and when she has done it, there shall come to her the highest and holiest joy known to mankind. And having done it, she shall have the reward prophesied in Scripture for her husband and her children, yes, and all people who realize that her work lies at the foundation of all national happiness and greatness shall rise up and call her blessed.